This is a paradox that we have encountered again and again and will encounter across California's development. We're developing this systematic, wholly paradoxical paradigm where we are trading nature to save nature. We are spending nature to save nature.
Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. I'm your host, Dr. Richard Lewis Miller. I'm an 85-year-old clinical psychologist, and I've been practicing for over 60 years. I bring you this question today to Obi Kaufman because I think he's one of the most interesting people that I have met on this program in 20 years. Go right to Google immediately. Obi Kaufman. You can get all the bio there. Until then, let's go with the interview. Hi, Obi. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Richard Miller. Fantastic. Thank you for that kind of introduction.
I told you before the interview that I was going to start out with a curveball. So here it is. There's a Marxian slogan, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. You're familiar with that, of course.
Of course.
How does that slogan relate to your work as a naturalist?
Well, there is a very thin line, really, between economics and ecology. They both etymologically come from a similar place, rooted in the quality of energy transference between individual agents within the home arena, which is what eco actually means in Greek. The root of it does anyway. And so I often threaten to freak everybody out and go back to school for my economics degree, because I think that there is a lot of really interesting interface between the human ecologies of economics, how human society deals with itself in terms of the greater fictions of what money is, in terms of how value is supported, in terms of material production and distribution. But as I've said, and I think I said this before when I was on your program last, that the ecological sciences, as Frank Herbert Gottlob Duhm says, ecology is the study of consequence. And as I go forward in this vocation of mine, there's a kind of magic well that I've found myself drawing from, this well of water, say, but it's a magic water. It's a water of knowledge, right? So as I take and keep drinking, there is more and more water to take. So I think that I'm going to stick with ecology, especially with the very interesting emergence of what may become a post-carbon economy, when all of our paradigms, modernist or otherwise, are usurped. Binary modes of this or that, especially in terms of economics, say Marxism or one of its potentially inevitable conclusion would have been the evolution of both branches of communism and socialism, where we've got those sort of conceived as a singular unit of definitions that have come to be thought of as equality and equity, as opposed to what those in, the only remaining world superpower, really, on some level, which is, the force that is America, and its economic system of capitalism, right? So we've got that binary that may or may not survive this ecological threshold that we find ourselves in. That surrounds us from all sides, really, with these vectors of stress to the core existential systems sustainability across all measures of human ecology. So, to each according to their need, that quote from Das Kapital, I believe, is such a compelling idea. We're finding is really responsible for perpetuating a lot of postmodern theory in regard to equity might actually fest themselves towards our daily lives and in our daily politics. Did that approach something like an answer?
Well, what I'm thinking is democracy in a republic which functions under capitalism looks to me much less likely to serve those according to their needs. And in theory, socialism and communism would be much more likely to serve those according to their needs. However, in practice, the only place where we see communism is in Russia and in China, maybe a few little sprinkles around the world, and both of those places are not appealing as particularly pleasant places to live, at least from my perspective here in the United States. On the other hand, our one global example of socialism, namely the Scandinavian countries, look like, except for their weather, extremely attractive places to live, because the Scandinavian countries offer something called cradle to grave, where people know that they're taken care of from cradle to grave. They're not going to starve to death. They're not going to freeze to death. They're taken care of. In our country, people don't know that. And so we have a situation, as we do today, because of the great economic stratification, whereby 70% of America live in fear that if they lose their jobs, they might be out on the street in a few weeks because they have nothing in the bank. Or if their refrigerator breaks or their stove breaks, they may not be able to feed their families because they can't buy a new one because they don't have the money.
That's fascinating. That's an interesting point that I would like to challenge to a certain degree as we might consider what our tradition thought of as a conservative or liberal arguments towards, I think, what you're talking about here, which is the argument of equity versus equality, and where equality bespeaks a sort of equality of opportunity, and equity means an equality of outcome.
Agreed.
So that's a conservative criticism towards the potentially socialist posture of redistribution that certainly Scandinavians do to a certain degree effectively. Of course, you have to remember that's a very geographically and historically specific situation that those countries have. And given a particular racial makeup as well, there's very little demographic parallel between what is happening in Scandinavia to what is happening in America across any spectrum of metric, right? So I'm finding in my own work much more interesting idea regarding bio-regional economies across, say, this political entity called California, right, which just surpassed Germany to become the world's greatest, fifth largest economy, all on its own, just the state of California. And we are just celebrating right now here in early spring 2024, more than a month, 38 consecutively, where the entire power grid of our state was sustained 100% renewable energy sources, just wind, solar, hydro, which is something not exactly, it's the first time in history this has been done across such a large demographic, 40 million people. Remember, Sweden is much larger than California, but it only has 10 million people, one quarter the population that California is, right? So,
yes.
So we're talking about apples and oranges, especially when you're talking something like Norway that is incredibly wealthy off of fossil fuels. Okay. So like that, you know, majority of Norway's wealth is from petroleum extraction. So we have a number of things going on across this very complex system that is ecology in the 21st century. All of these emergent phenomena that are arising everywhere, balancing those, finding some sort of meaning. I know that your work, Dr. Miller, is often wrapped up in sort of the onion that is human experience, embedded in this idea of meaning. However,
meaning.
It is tied to consciousness, mortality, morality, in an ecological sense, right? So I began this little soliloquy here in terms of a dynamic that I find much more interesting than, say, like the liberal conservative or the communistic versus the capitalistic. The one that the interesting critique that I find to be a dynamic I come back to again and again is the indigenous critique of colonial ideas. Okay, so this is an interesting fracture of two sides of the argument that is really, in my estimation, not discussed enough. There are convergences and there are horribly violent historical divergences in what those two dynamics actually represent, the indigenous and the colonial, the history in the American West, at least we have the history of genocide, enslavement, and erasure of native cultures. In this time of resurgence, let's come back to California, of native Californians, the unprecedented seat at the table of California has inside Sacramento right now.
Mm-hmm.
The doorway that is open towards this great fusion of what I believe are core human schools of thought. Let's say, for example, especially in the modernist paradigm, we have scientific scientific innovation on the one hand, and we have traditional ecological knowledge, TEK, and other tech on the other hand, right? The emergence of these two schools of thought then applied towards this powerhouse of California.
Yes.
I think is a bedrock for no end of hope, and indeed, dare I say, optimism.
You know, since we talked last time, we've been through a tremendous drought that you had deep concerns about when you and I have talked. Deep concerns about what it's going to do to life on Earth, actually. Last year, we had a lot of rain. And this year, I'm here at Wilbur Hot Springs right now. We're having a banner year. We've got over 24 inches of rain. Talk to us about the effects of the drought and now the rain. Are we now safe? What are your thoughts on that, please?
Yes. Okay. Very good. Okay. So this gets a lot going on in that statement. I wouldn't for life on Earth. Okay. So, when we're talking about the climate crisis, we're really talking about carbon in the atmosphere, heating as a blanket to produce what we have seen to be the hottest series of years, end over end, average across the planet, especially in the 21st century. It's ongoing, this parade of increasing temperatures. Now, there is a lot of, there is, for every point of despair here, there is a point of hope because of the emergent complexity of the situation. When we're talking about rain, when we're talking about precipitation, we're talking about, there is something that is happening across the California floristic province right now that is process of increased aridity despite rain events. Okay, so the distribution increased precipitation over the past 2 years follows a patterns of trade winds in the Eastern Pacific Ocean, which are known as El Nino and La Nina. We're moving from an El Nino year into a La Nina here, and it turns out that this was a whopper of an El Nino. And so we're measuring a couple of things here in terms of relevancy of what actually water in the ecosystems across the California mosaic might mean. Okay, so when you have a tick global temperature, especially California, you have a corresponding geometric increase of what is called the vapor deficit inside the wood body of botanical life across California. You have this desiccation of trees, right? And that is a very dangerous trend, especially given, frankly, fire suppression policy over the past 100 years across California, where now we have a situation because of the exclusion of fire in California, because of the exclusion of wildland fire. Believe it or not, there has been a great exclusion of wildland fire over the past 100 years. We have more trees in California. We have more trees in California right now than California has ever had in its entire geologic history.
God, that's wonderful to hear.
Well, it is. And let me explain what I mean by that. Our forests are mostly, well, it's about 32% of California's 100 million acres are forested, and nearly all of those acres are overcrowded, drought stressed, infirmed, beetle ridden. They were never meant. Okay. Apparently, projecting some moral emphasis somehow on my statements here. They were never, and what I, but I,
that was a good catch. That's a great catch.
I think that I can pick it up though. If you bear with me.
I love you doing that. You heard yourself.
Exactly. Well, let me explain. In order to go forward with this argument, I need to back up for a second and describe what and how California forests evolved. Okay, so if your listener is not quite familiar with my work, I've just finished my sixth book, which is called The State of Fire, Why California Burns. And in this book that is coming out in the fall by Heyday Books, my research has led me to the conclusion, and it's well-sourced, might I say, that the forests of California in their present configuration are really only about as old as the Great Pyramids. About 5,000 years old, 5 to 6,000 years old, when following the beginning, the Holocene era, we have about a 5,000 year period when Earth's climate coming down from the Pleistocene era, which preceded the Holocene era, from what is called the last glacial maximum, which is more accurately called the most recent glacial maximum. Okay. So when the sea level of California was 250 feet below where it is today, you could walk from Point Reyes to the Farallon Islands 18,000 years ago. And you would walk across the plain with about 24 species of herbivorous megafauna that don't exist today, including 3 species of mammoth and the largest camel that ever lived and a bunch of giant ground sloths and those kind of animals that all disappeared in the early Holocene mass extinction that then about 6,000 years ago with the development of the San Francisco Bay, we now have the beginnings of this incredibly diverse, incredibly sophisticated, pyrologically based, pyrologically or you could say pyrocultural economies across the state in terms of over 150 tribes, hundreds of thousands of people living here in these very sophisticated systems of pyrogenic agriculture. So regular return of fire on a big scale. We used to have a lot of fire here, and that shaped California forests in a way such that when you think, you hear the word old growth a lot, right? In terms of forests.
Yes.
So trees, by way of their habitat distribution and their other botanical association, get together in this thing called old growth. Every coniferous species, think spruce, fir, redwood, all have particular characteristics that manifest in this thing called old growth or late seral successive forests, right? So at the end of these great, or they're also called climax ecosystems. Okay, so these old growth systems where you have about 40 trees per acre. Okay, now we're dealing in a situation at the beginning of the 21st century where we're dealing with upwards of 600 trees per acre. Okay, so and this is because of the absence of human stewardship across California's firescape. Okay. So fire, it's been said by fire historian Stephen Pine, for example, that fire put out is a fire delayed in California. In California, this is what I said in my previous book, The Forests of California, that fire itself, that trees in California are fire waiting to burn. They are made of fire. I look at the forest and I see fire in California. And I think this is an indigenous critique to
fire as a natural pruner, as a natural cleaner-upper, if you will, correct? I mean, you're talking about going from 40 trees per acre to 600 trees. Now, as a psychologist, I'm aware of a phenomenon that's called a behavioral sink. A behavioral sink is where you crowd so many people into a neighborhood that it's almost suffocating. Yeah. There was a great study done on Harlem originally, yeah, and that was the first behavioral sink where people were crowded in so much that it was no wonder there was an excess of crime. Because when people are crowded in that way, They become irritated. They become a little paranoid. They become upset. And I'm wondering, is that what's going on when you crowd 600 trees? Are the trees irritated? Are they unhappy? Are they talking to each other and saying, what the hell's going on here? This neighborhood is suffocating us. Are they?
I think that that's an interesting hypothesis. I think that the experiments to exactly draw that kind of analogy have yet to be dreamt up. Perhaps there is a young scientist in your audience right now who is thinking about, who is dreaming about the experiment that might be able to draw.
Well, what can you tell us about what happens when you have a neighborhood of trees that goes from 40 to 600?
Right. We get a situation which would be called by ecologists simplification. Okay, so we've got and a simple ecosystem is a brittle ecosystem. What you want, and this goes to my original argument about why biodiversity crisis might be more important, more salient, if you will, than even the climate crisis. The biodiversity crisis is based on the, albeit largely the assumption that the greater the diversity, the greater the resiliency. And the thinking there goes directly from biodiversity towards the stability of human communities everywhere. Okay, so the
greater the diversity, the greater the resilience. Obi, as soon as you said that, the first thing I thought of is maybe that's what's made the United States such a powerful nation, because people came to the United States from all over the world, whereas other countries around the world are much more homogeneous. Their people have all been there for long periods of time, and they've homogenized.
Well, just
an idea.
Yeah. I think that there are certainly sociobiological applications there as well. I think that ecological thought as it translates towards patterns of sociology are absolutely applicable.
Bring us back to the drought and the rain, please.
Okay, so. So when we're talking about drought in California, we haven't seen anything. California, we do know historically, and in fact, people of California are still around to tell us about what happened. They still have the stories to communicate to us about what happened when. We're not talking about 5 years of drought. We're not talking about 20 years of drought. We're talking about centuries of drought. When the world, that is California, which is my world, there was biological resiliencies. Okay, so and this is verified by climate science, largely given in like pollen records and that kind of thing that we can trace across California's history over the past, you know, the late Holocene here. A couple of things have happened. One is that the past 170 years have been particularly a wet, moist, and water heavy time in California, if you will. You know, we saw more precipitation in the past 170 years since that guy found that pretty rock in that river by our state's capital, that they, you know, this actually became the modern entity of California. We have been blessed with a lot of water, more water than California historically for hundreds or thousands of years prior. We do understand, interestingly, though, is that despite 100 years, you know, these mega droughts, these centuries that we've seen a few mega droughts such as this, in the past couple thousand years, as I'm saying, where it doesn't appear that California lost a single species. Okay, so a century of drought did not translate into any sort of process of simplification, which is the opposite of diversification.
Okay, but you did say we got acidification.
I said aridification.
Aridification. Yeah, thank you.
The trending towards greater aridity, specifically inside of the wood body or the vapor deficit of the arboreal habitat.
So a couple of years of rain don't necessarily impact that aridification. Is that right?
No, they certainly do not, given the greater trends. Now, what concerns me most, an ecologist, given what has happened over and what is happening across California, is not necessarily like, so what is the great mystery? How did California survive, you know, these century-long droughts without losing a single measurable aspect of its biodiverse portfolio? And it seems more and more likely that it was because of the systems of biodiversity that were already in place, have been so weakened, fragmented, and segregated from one another now in California's current urban configuration, for example, we've had a couple of inner species, if you will, real indicator species of these ecological engineers, as they're called. One would be like the beaver. Okay, so there, before there was the gold rush, there was the fur rush. All those state parks named after those guys, like Jedediah Smith, and these early Americans who were coming into California before statehood was established. You got Kit Carson, you've got the Russians coming over, Fort Ross. The treasure was the fur of the mammals, the beaver and the sea otters out towards the coast. But the beaver were so populous that these guys just were able to walk up these creek sheds and kill all the beaver. You know, we're talking about population densities across California, everything west of the Sierra Crest. Beaver populations of 1 to 2 every kilometer of water course, right? Across every kilometer of water course. This was an incredible source of ecological engineering at the hands of that busy little rodent. The beaver is an amazing creature. What we see across everywhere that the beaver is, the most recent findings is that there is a 50-fold increase in biodiversity around the beaver pond or the beaver lot, what beavers do natural. Okay, so this is why California has now finally entered the fight with the beaver restoration program, and for the first time in California's history, beaver have been released back into the wild across 10 strategic watersheds in California this past year. So this is a major step forward in restoration. This is a restoration program.
Because we're doing beaver restoration here at Wilbur Hot Springs.
Is that right?
Yeah, and people are coming here in groups, and they're putting branches in the creeks and building up what they call beaver dams and hoping that beavers are going to come. Will they come? Will they come, or do you have to bring them in, import some, so they'll multiply?
Well, I'm not familiar with that, with the work you're talking about specifically, but I understand that to be kind of a, what process actually is installing beaver analog. Okay. So that's like actually laying the branches down. What beaver actually need is the trees planted. Okay. Because they'll build their own dams. Thank you. And so actually the reintroduction of beaver necessarily needs dedicated on the established beaver ready habitat. It's a problem. It's difficult because beaver don't do their thing always where you want them to do their thing. And that can be very frustrating for, say, you know, the farming community. But beaver are just one aspect of this larger portfolio of this ancient system, this ancient portfolio of biodiversity that California once had that it doesn't anymore. Okay, so I think that you can apply the system writ large across the biosphere in terms of something like a James Lovelock Gaia theory, where it seems like the systems are resilient by their own nature, given their own complexity and engineering design. And this is rooted in this indigenous critique, I say, because there is a cultural interface that is accessible to the modern mind, even the colonial mind, even the mind that I have here about, this tennis game I have, in my head between my ears. We've got, with this colonial thought that I was raised in, you see, like I was raised by my father, the astrophysicist, and my mother, the psychologist. Obi Kaufman was going to be a mathematician. Dr. Kaufman's son was going to be a mathematician. I have more of a background in math than I do have in art or ecology, right? But this has all led me to this ethical quandary, this place that we're in. And I think that has a lot to do with, even go back to the beginning of our conversations, we begin to turn around. We begin to think about, what we need. And I can't help as a writer, as an artist, as a forger of these books, what is the best language that we can apply towards these burgeoning and emerging thoughts across what might be called this landscape of ecological philosophy. The ecological philosopher Timothy Morton said that we've experienced this kind of severing. Okay, this severing has us freely using such meaningless or even commodified words as like nature itself. Nature is a word that has very little meaning. I'm not exactly sure on any granular level how that can really be applied towards my experience of the world epistemologically. It's like, does nature exist like 3 feet out from my body everywhere, or is it part me? Isn't it a part of me? How could it be anything else?
Definitely.
And that, I imagine that dovetails into your vocation, of course, Dr. Miller, because, I'm not exactly sure if what's happening here.
From my perspective, Obi, we cannot separate ourselves from nature because we are part of nature.
Right.
And so when we look out, what we're seeing is more nature, but it's not separate from us. It just is us. I feel the same way and think the same way about the planet. We don't live on the planet. We're part of the planet. It's all one big organism that we're part of.
Right. But we have to do it. We use this shorthand nature, and we do it tongue in cheek, and we don't even realize that we're doing it tongue in cheek.
That's right.
When you employ the word nature, you are commodifying. You are set, and then there's this whole matriculation of the other words that come out of that. Say the word resources, natural resources. What are natural resources except for things to be spent or things to be conserved? There's that word conservation.
Yes.
Only work in particular project oriented or commercial based endeavors.
Exactly. Exactly. Good designation there.
Well, okay. Getting.
I was teaching in the late 60s at the University of Michigan, and I met a psychiatrist who was living at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur named Frederick Fritz Perls. And he had origined a theory of psychology called Gestalt therapy. And I came out to study with him at Esalen. And one of the things that he emphasized was in working with patients or working with the world, with people, is pay attention to the obvious. Always pay attention to the obvious. And I would be remiss if I didn't pay attention to the obvious. And here in this interview. So there are two things that are obvious to me that I must ask you about. One is, what's on the wall behind you that looks like a classic Rorschach test? Okay, what is that Rorschach test on your wall?
Oh, it's the exceptional taste of my sister-in-law's kitchen tile.
Okay, well, it's an interesting design. Next, yeah, it looks like a Rorschach. The next thing I want to ask you about are your tattoos. Show us the tattoo on the back of your right hand. It looks like a beetle. What is it? It's what?
It's a honeybee, Apis mellifera, the European honeybee.
Okay, and let's see the back of your other hand.
This is a sunspot designed about 15 years ago. And I've got a Coyote Thunder here, and Coyote Thunder is my Instagram handle. And my knuckles say wildlife.
The knuckles say wildlife?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us a story about you putting the butterfly, the honeybee on your back of your head.
I think that it's symbolic somehow of some, you know, core piece of my identity when I did that regarding relationship towards the stewardship and engagement in the natural world. I think that I haven't gotten a tattoo in quite some time. It used to be a part of my life.
How long ago did you do the tattoos?
My best friend in the world, Matt Decker, down at Premium Tattoo in Oakland here, is still making a pretty good living creatively expressing himself through running a little tattoo business. Out to Matt Decker, Premium Tattoo.
Hi, Matt.
and so he ushered me at previous different stages of my life through sort of a start and stop relationship with being a tattoo artist myself. But I've kind of moved on from that necessarily is in terms of greater expression. So, you know, back in the day, Dr. Miller, I was really a gallery artist. You know, I was really trying to push my paintings as what in terms of a modernist, let's use that word again, commodification, right? Like how can I make these objects of some sort of aesthetic value into some sort of economic value, you know, for my own edification.
Yes.
But I really only ever attained whatever modicum of success I have attained with my artistic career after I had given it all away, after I had left that sort of ego front of the artwork of Obi Kaufman, gave it all away to the thing that I love most in this universe, which is the more than human world of California.
Do you have any paintings from those days?
They're around.
I would love to see one sometime.
Well, okay.
I am such a fan of the paintings that you do in your books. I talk about you, as I mentioned before, as an Olympian. I mean, folks listening to this, Obi Kaufman doesn't produce books. He produces encyclopedias of nature, if you will. And they really are. And they're a joy to read. You go to Amazon and go to Obi Kaufman and you'll see them. It's my pleasure to be an ambassador for you. Okay.
I appreciate that. You can go directly to my website and buy my books just for me. It's at californiafieldatlas.com.
Say it again.
californiafieldatlas.com.
Thank you. Obi, here at Wilbur Hot Springs, we have a creek going through the property. Before the last 5-10 years of drought, this creek would flow all year round.
Yes.
And in the spring after the winter, it was so high that friends of mine said I shouldn't drive across it in a Jeep because I could get pulled away. This year, we had over 24 inches of rain. Anything over 15 or 16 makes us happy. Over 24 inches. I go to the creek. There's not much in it. Not much in it. There's no issue about driving across. I can easily walk across. 2 years in a row of rain, it hasn't been replenished. Can you talk to us a little about that?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about the specifics. I would imagine there's a bit of diversion going on there as well, given the agricultural community in East.
No, we're 22 miles from the nearest town here. 22 miles in either direction. There's nothing to divert the water. This is the same stream and the same creek that's been for 100 years.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what's going on with the hydrology there. I'm fascinated by your little area, though. I was working with the California Native Plant Society on what's called Walker Ridge, which is just up the road from you.
I can see it from where I'm sitting. It's right there. Yeah.
Very good. Well, perhaps you know then that it's been named Molokliok. Have you heard that?
Say it again.
Molokliok, the place of condors, the home of condors. So this is the Lake County Pomo word, and it looks like any day now we're waiting on an announcement from President Biden that will expand Berryessa Snow Mountain National Monument across Walker Ridge, across Molokliok. I guess it's about 13,000 acres or so. So it's about 20 square miles that will be incorporated and protected from what was going to be an enormous wind farm.
That's correct. I was scared that they were going to put a wind farm right here, right above where I'm sitting, and they were going to put lights that we'd see at night, and the birds would get killed. This is great news, Obi.
Yeah, this is great news. We're waiting. It's expected to. It'll probably go through. We'll get an announcement from the Secretary of the Department of Interior, Deborah Holland, announcing the National Monument expansion. And I think really, really, and this is California Plant Society, CMPS, have this real insight in how they documented the decline of a specific species of wildflower that would have been endangered by the development of this wind farm. And, you know, I tell you, Dr. Miller, this is a obstacle. This is a conundrum. This is paradox that we have encountered again and again and will encounter across California's development into the, you know, second half of the 21st century, as we are concerning ourselves with developing alternative energies. We're developing this systematic, wholly paradoxical paradigm where we are exchanging, we are trading nature for to save nature. We're spending nature to save nature. How about that for a completely new thing?
You know, I understand that so deeply, OBB, because, you know, I started the health sanctuary here at Wilbur Hot Springs in 1972, and I never put the entire place on the grid. So for 20-odd years, we had 178 kerosene lights, and then we were pioneers in photovoltaic. So now the entire place is electrified with photovoltaic. We're not on the grid. But now people are telling me that in order to be doing this, I'm raping the earth and taking out lithium that's necessary for my photovoltaic system. And I'm thinking, oh shit, I didn't want to create a problem by thinking I was solving a problem.
So there's a lot of problems with solar panels. Lithium isn't the mineral we're concerned about, but there are a lot of, they can be called conflict minerals or, you know, rare earth minerals is another one. Solar panels as they exist now don't have a robust recycling program and have a very finite lifespan. So, for example, I just wrote this book on the deserts of California, where we are, where this conundrum that I describe is most acutely manifest in the building boom of the desert, where we are raising it, R-A-Z-E, raising it to build these solar farms that are destroying the very sensitive, delicate, ancient thing that is the Mojave Desert in order to produce these megawatts for what? A couple of decades until the panels themselves have outlived their useful life. So we have significant technical challenges, so shall we say, towards that are at odds, I believe, with something like a Leopoldian land ethic, which I think should begin to, and I believe it is. I think that there's reason to believe that this is a light on the horizon. This idea of the land ethic being, if it is good for the land, it is good for the. Okay, so in its most simple terms, that's not a direct quote, as he puts it, from the Santa County Almanac, but it's reflected in other agrarian philosophers of like Wendell Berry, say, who says, we don't solve one problem, we solve all problems at the same time. You do that by solving for pattern, okay? And often is involves greater diversity, greater complexity, and racing that story. And so it's interesting, you know, in this conversation, you and I spent a good deal of time talking about the beaver, which is one aspect of this larger resiliency map has turned in terms of, you know, vertebral biodiversity across this. I would love to go on and on, actually, and talk about how all of these different systems, from the very smallest mycological phenomena to the very largest apex predators historically and in the future, such as the disappearance of that magnificently charismatic creature that we put on our state flag, the California grizzly. Right now in 2024, we are commemorating, memorializing, we are mourning the 100th year since the last one was killed in the Sierra National Forest in 1924.
Let me take you to a sidebar. What's the name of the group that's leading the charge on the Walker Ridge to create the national monument?
The California Native Plant Society.
Thank you.
CNPS. Yes. What a wonderful group they are. They are one of many. You can also go to Tuleomi.org.
Oh, I know them.
Yes.
They hold the land conservation deed that I put on 1,560 acres here at Wilbur Hot Springs. Yes. I am sitting right now in a deeded nature preserve that Tuleomi oversees and will be a nature preserve in perpetuity. It's my legacy.
Wonderful. It is so great to hear.
Oh, yeah.
Good work. That's like the epitome of this grassroots thing, right? That comes from bottom up, right? That almost gets us back to the beginning of our conversation, doesn't it? I don't have a lot of faith in the top down stuff. There's a lot of top down stuff that's very interesting. Okay. But when we think of things like the new state law 30 by 30, protecting 30% of California's lands and waters by the year 2030, which is spearheaded by the California Department of Natural Resources, which is now competently administered by Wade Crowfoot, who is the head of the Natural Resources Agency. He's a great guy and he's become a good friend. And he has he's really empowered by the Newsom administration to build the momentum necessary to make this thing actually happen. My criticism of the 30 by 30, of course, is that that is not some sort of receipt that we therefore can trash the other 70. And 30 by 30 only really makes sense if we're talking about 50 by 50 as well. In terms of defense, as I say, of California's endemic resiliencies based in biodiversity, we need as much land as we can. And by land, I mean habitat. And habitat, I mean ecosystems that are built, that are structured, that are composed wholly of biodiversity stewarded by the human hand. You know, in my new book, when The State of Fire, Why California Burns, I posit it is not because of trees that California burns, but it is because of decisions made or decisions not made by people. That's the way it's been for thousands of years in the past, and that's the way it will be for thousands of years in the future, spirit willing. Okay. So, you know, I know that we're running out of time here, but I tell you, we've only just begun this conversation. We got to move on to chapter 3 of our conversation soon, Dr. Miller.
I would love to have you back. And I'm going to introduce you to someone who is now involved in stewarding Wilbur Hot Springs, a man named Will Marshall, who is very, do you know Will?
Can't remember.
Okay.
Give me some more facts.
I'll introduce you. He was a NASA rocket scientist, and he started a company called Planet, LANET, that puts up satellites that are taking photographs of everything on the surface of the Earth. And he was involved in putting this beaver program together here at Wilbur Hot Springs, amongst other things. Yeah, and he started a naturalist program here, too, where naturalists come and have naturalist classes. So I'm going to introduce you. Before we quit, very briefly, is there a project you're involved with right now that you want our listeners to know about?
Yeah, always, for sure. I think that I'm about to go on a speaking tour across California, 9 dates over the past, over the next month and a half or so.
Yes.
I'm calling the tour Learning to Be From Here, which I think it gets to the heart of the heart and nature of my vocation itself, the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning, being from California, how can I finally leave behind whatever biases I carry around and finally attain some sort of connection or atonement with this piece of the cosmos I love above all else. Well, I know that it's not a destination that I'm aiming towards, but rather a process that I'm going through. I am inviting everyone to check out those tour dates, and you can follow me on Instagram at Coyote Thunder. Just one word, Coyote Thunder, which is the best way to follow my daily-ish postings, musings, and paintings. So that's probably the best thing to plug right now. And this fall, I've got my new book coming out, The State of Fire, Why California Burns, out from Heyday Books. It'll be here sometime in October, fire season. We'll see how this goes.
Tell us the name of your website again, please.
It's californiafieldatlas.com.
Last question for the interview. When are you going to come up and stay with me at Wilbur Hot Springs for a day or two? It's only 2 hours away from where you live.
I love it. I love it up there.
You know what? When you come up, I'll take you on an ATV right up in my neighborhood here, and we'll go up on Walker Ridge Road.
See if we
can find a condor.
Or some rare wildflowers.
Terrific.
All right.
Wonderful being with Nobi.
Take care. Thank you so much.